My name's Tim Jackson. I'm a Professor of Sustainable Development at the University of Surrey and Director of the Centre for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity.
So, Professor Jackson, why is economic growth a conditio sine qua non for modern capitalism? Why is the dilemma of growth? What is the dilemma of growth we are facing? Is it the world secular religion?
Is it the what?
The world's secularization.
Is growth the religion? Sometimes it seems like it. Growth is, I would say growth has been seen to be synonymous with things getting better, with people's well-being. And there's a sort of a rationale for that, because certainly earlier you could say that if you didn't have enough food, then you know you weren't going to live very long. If you didn't have shelter, you wouldn't eat, and all of those things required the production of physical stuff, material stuff. And so it would seem that the more of that you had, the better off you were as a society. And that's a sort of a rationale for saying, well, let's just keep growth going. And then it became a part of the system. And in particular, in a capitalist society where you, as an entrepreneur, you chase profits all the time, you're continually seeking more and more labor productivity, which means getting more out of each worker in each hour as the years go by, which means that you need fewer of them next year unless the economy grows, which means that you're torn between growth and unemployment. And that's a part of the dynamic, the dilemma of growth. We keep on growing and that's unsustainable, but as soon as we stop growing, things get tough, people lose their jobs, firms go out of business, and governments who don't respond properly find themselves out of office.
Why is the whole economic model broken, and why do we need a replacement? It's an old question. Should capitalism be abolished or reformed?
Yeah, I mean, the model's broken in all sorts of ways. It's most obvious, I suppose, since the financial crisis, that we've kind of not really known what to do since the crisis, and we've tried various ways to get growth back again and hasn't quite worked, and the financial system itself is deeply flawed and has all kinds of inequality in particular built into it. So since the crisis, the people who have owned financial assets, the richest 1%, have got richer, and some of the poorest people in the world have become poorer. And so there's a clear mandate to change a model that's delivering that sort of inequality. It is partly about capitalism. It is about the dynamics of capitalism. It's about the way in which profit is generated, the way in which it is concentrated in the hands of too few people, and the way in which those profits pay no attention to the quality of life of the poorest in society or of the planet. And so perhaps the old questions about capitalism are worth asking again, that it is about time to come round and ask actually whether this capitalist model, certainly as it is fit for purpose in the future. And I would argue probably that it's not. Whether that means you transform it or you overthrow it, I think partly depends how you define capitalism.
Is degrowth a solution?
Degrowth is interestingly become a very, I wouldn't say popular idea, but it's become a very prevalent idea in the last few years. And there are good reasons for that. Degrowth is really a kind of way of critiquing the growth-based paradigm. And asking the question, you know, is there an alternative? And that's a good question to ask. It's an essential question to ask. But whether the solution is that we kind of somehow turn round growth, that we, instead of chasing, you know, positive GDP growth, we chase negative GDP growth, I somehow doubt that's going to that's going to fix the problems on its own. So the kinds of problems that need to be fixed are the ones related to the dynamics of capitalism, and those dynamics begin to work against you when you fall into at least certain kinds of degrowth. When the economy starts to collapse, then those dynamics begin to work against you. So the challenge for the degrowth concept is to show how an economy might work when it isn't relentlessly chasing growth.
What does prosperity actually mean to us as human beings?
I think in a way that's the most interesting question. Certainly the way prosperity is mainly talked about, it's talked about as a rising living standard, and that's typically assumed to mean that we have more things, more material things. But actually, beyond a certain level, the needs of human beings are not entirely material. They're at least partly social and psychological, and some might even say spiritual. Certainly some sense of meaning or purpose is a large part of what it means to be human, and a large part of what we're continually seeking, sometimes perversely seeking through a very consumerist society, and sometimes also not very successfully seeking, so that the stuff that is supposed to be making us happier perversely doesn't appear to be making us all that much happier. And in the process of chasing after it, we sometimes lose sight of the things that matter, the sense of meaning and purpose in life. So a part of the job, I think, is to reconceptualize, to redefine prosperity, and to say, you know, what does it mean? Obviously, if you don't have enough food to eat, you're going to starve, and nobody could say that was very prosperous. But beyond that point, beyond shelter, beyond the obvious kind of sense of clothing and protection against the elements and being physically nourished, actually, it's more about participation. It's more about being part of the life of society. It's more about having friends and family. It's more about having a community and a sense of community, and being able to identify some sense of meaning in your life, meaningful work, decent work, contributing to society. And those factors are incredibly important to human beings, it turns out.
Pope Francis criticizes, in order to see on care for our common house, the extreme consumerism, you call it an iron cage.
Yeah, I call it an iron cage because it seems like we're locked into it. I mean, it seems like a kind of cage. It seems like we don't have anywhere to turn other than consumerism, and that is how it looks certainly at the moment. And the bars of the cage, if you like, are in part the structure of enterprise. The fact that enterprise is continually having to reinvent itself to chase novelty in order to stay ahead of the competition. And on the other side, on the other hand, novelty excites us as human beings. We somehow, it's very seductive to have all these new things constantly paraded in front of us. And that novelty is a part of how in the consumer society we begin to construct prosperity, how we construct hope. The world is a brighter, shinier place in the future than it is today, and we can prove it because we have all this lovely, shiny new stuff that lots of clever people have laid in front of us. And so it's that sort of cage. It's a cage where the temptations to the human soul, to the human psyche, are exactly the things that the entrepreneurial system, the economic system, is set up to deliver. And that continual chasing after novelty becomes a part of the cage that confines us.
What do you understand by the term consumerism theodicy?
Theodicy. Yes. Theodicy is very, well, it's an odd term to use in some ways because it's a very religious term. And when you're engaged in a secular debate, it's not always best to choose religious terminology, but the theodicy, it's odd to me that there isn't a better, more familiar word for theodicy. But it goes back to Leibniz, to early philosophy, really, and the idea that actually God has something to answer for, because the world in which he or she left us or installed us and now does or doesn't watch over us, depending on what your belief system says, is not always a very happy one. It's not one in which good things happen all the time, even to the best of people. And sometimes very bad things happen to the best of people, to the people who deserve it least. And somehow we have to justify that. We have to figure out where meaning lies in a world in which bad things happen to good people. And this was a particular problem in religion, because we had an idea of a benevolent God. We had an idea of a God who made the world, created it in his own image. It was the best for us. And as Leibniz says, the best of all possible worlds. And yet somehow this best of all possible worlds has bad things in it. And religious theodicy sought for some time, really, to kind of figure out what that meant for their ideas about a deity, about an all-powerful, benevolent deity. And in the middle of the, I would say in the middle of the 19th century, that search for meaning, that search for what it's all about when such bad things can happen, reached a kind of crisis point. And the crisis point coincided with two things, really. One was the rise of the theory of evolution and Darwin, and basically Darwin's answer was, no, sorry, guys, there's no God, so there's nothing to worry about. And also the rise of capitalism, which produced a wonderful new way of making meaning out of our lives. And that's to me is the consumer theodicy. It's a theodicy in which says, no, forget heaven, forget the hereafter. Paradise on earth is what we're after. And paradise on earth can be delivered by a kind of consumerism, and this consumerism can make sense of our lives. And all of the tough questions that you want to ask about doing well and about being successful and about your children having a good life and about their life being better than ours, you can answer all of these questions in the consumer theodicy, at least, just by having more stuff. And of course, it's deeply flawed. It's as flawed as Leibniz's theodicy was, and as flawed as the theodicy of the 19th century was. But theodicy, it turns out, that search for meaning is a critical part of the human condition, and somehow we can't get away without it. We must ask those tough questions.
Please tell me something more about the new model of economy. How is it possible to maintain economic stability, ensure full employment, and remain within ecological constraints and resource limit of the finest planet?
How long do I have? So the first thing to say about it, I suppose, is that, you know, many of the impossibility theorems that you encounter when you start to talk about a different kind of economy are largely inaccurate. They're false impossibility theorems. So the argument that you can't employ people unless you have growth, you know, turns out to be nuts. It turns out to be completely wrong, that you can employ as many people as you want if you have the resources to do that. You just can't continually chase after profit through labor productivity, which is the dynamic that pushes them out of work. So you just have to, in a sense, as alternative economists for 50 or 60 years have talked about, you have to turn that idea on its head and say, actually, decent work is the foundation of a true prosperity. If you don't have people working and participating in society, you don't really have a society. You just have a set of people who are trying to cream profits from each other at their own expense. And there are very, very different ways of thinking about organizing work, which many different societies have had over time. And those ideas are the ones that we need to go back to, that actually one of the roles of government, for example, as quite a well-known economist, Hyman Minsky, once said, is to provide employer of last resort, that you don't have a society in which you allow unemployment to reach critical levels where it creates social unrest, and you do it by employing people. And if you look around the world and ask, well, where would you employ them? Are there no kids that need teaching, no people suffering from critical illnesses that need care? Are there no disabled people that should be actually a little bit hands-on attention would make a difference to the quality of their lives? Are there no buildings to be renovated? Are there no parks to be built? Are there no new projects with museums and theaters and children's centers and even religious quiet centers perhaps to be maintained, to be looked after? Is there nothing to do in the world? Is the world a place where there is nothing for people to do? And it's just when you ask the question and turn the question on its head that way, it becomes a ridiculous question, because there's so much to do in the world. There's so much improvement of people's lives and of our own lives. It is rather a structural deficiency in the system of employment that means that we can't actually engage people as much as we should in those tasks. So this is a part of what a different economy looks like. It looks like a place where people have decent work, where they are able to participate in society. And of course, you can't answer all the hard questions that way. You also have to occasionally indulge in some economic modeling, and you have to ask the question, well, you know, how does your full employment society, where people are doing decent regenerative work, how does it maintain financial stability? And you might very well find that actually some of the architecture of the existing system won't quite work. You might not have credit default swaps, which hide the toxic burden of unwieldy assets and then collapse your housing market. That might not be a feature of this new system, but perhaps that's not such a bad thing. Perhaps there's another way of organizing finance. And then you start to do a little bit of modeling and you ask the question, you know, could we get a decent level of employment? Could we get a little bit of financial stability? And do we have to have growth to achieve that? And you find actually there are as many possibilities out there as you can imagine for how an economy should actually work. And the task actually is just to articulate those possibilities, to test the kinds of institutions that you need to make them work, and then to get on with the job.
Is there any political strategy to get from where we are to where you want us to be?
Well, I think there are several political strategies. I mean, I don't think there's a one that I would say, yeah, this is the right one. Because I think if we'd found that, we probably would have been a little further on. But, I mean, the classic tension is between working inside the system and saying there are things here that we can decently change. Working, for example, within the financial system, working with investors, working in particular with institutional investors who have responsibility for the security of our pensions and our insurances, and saying to them, is it really in your best interests to have a fragile financial system which creates continual crises and isn't really in any decent position to look after the long-term economic security of the elderly? Or would it be better perhaps to have a financial system that has longer, securer, more ethical returns? Better for your shareholders, better for people, better for society, better for the planet. And the astonishing thing, I think, is that there are lots of people inside the financial system who think in exactly those terms and who work for exactly those ends. So that's a part of the model of change. But there are also those who work in policy, who work in government, who find it harder. On the whole, they find it harder really to ask those tough questions because of the demands of electoral cycles. And that kind of leads you sometimes to wonder whether actually working outside the system is a better option. And that working outside the system isn't necessarily trying to tear the system down. It's just trying to build a different way of doing things. So build different alternatives to a financial system. Look at local mutual trusts to fund community projects instead of seeking large-scale funding from banks, for example, or creating green bonds which can fund renewable investment, or simply doing some peer-to-peer lending, which is one of those things that's remarkably emerged from the internet world, from the electronic world, that we don't actually need these big institutions that are all designed to fail to accommodate our need for some sort of financial smoothing and leverage. All of this can happen. It can't easily happen without some sort of governance, some sort of governance model that is open to it. And I think that's the most difficult question, really, how to bring policy round to the need for these changes. And I think that probably one of the things over the last few years that I increasingly feel is that they don't have a lot of choice. This is the last generation of politicians, I think, that has the luxury of choosing not to do something about a broken growth model, because all the evidence suggests that the growth isn't coming back in the way that politicians would like it to, that the needs of the planet are becoming more and more obvious. And in Paris, we signed up to an extraordinary agreement to limit carbon emissions, to limit warming by less than 1.5 degrees, which imposes extraordinary demands on our energy system. And the levels of inequality that we see in the world are giving rise to more and more social unrest. There is no model of going forwards in the way that politicians believed there was in the past, and that to me is not a brand new model of change. It's just the blindingly obvious that when those kinds of conditions face policymakers, the challenge of governance itself has to be transformed. You have to start thinking in different ways. There is no single model for policy change, but there are numerous avenues for change, and not many possibilities for going on the way we have in the past.
We've talked about grow. What about fairness? Does the third world have the equal right to a high standard of living? How much growth will be possible for the poor world?
I mean, almost the starting point really for the whole analysis is asking the question, how much growth is possible on the finite planet? When you look at the evidence, it's really, really clear where growth is needed. If you look at the relationship between life expectancy and income per capita, you find that for very low incomes, life expectancy improves incredibly fast for any increase in those incomes. So between £5,000 and £10,000 per capita, life expectancy improves, it practically doubles from 40 to 75 or so. And then after that point, you have a lot of countries who have managed to achieve a life expectancy of 75, 80, even higher on incomes that are around about $10,000 per capita. And then you have countries who earn 60, 70, 80, $90,000 per capita on average, with no more life expectancy. There's a point at which growth stops delivering the same kinds of returns. When you look at the data on infant mortality, it's even more striking that all you have to do really is to bring people's incomes up to about £5,000 or £10,000 on average globally, and you completely almost eliminate infant mortality. And after that point, you don't get so many gains in terms of basic indicators of health like life expectancy and infant mortality. And so it's absolutely clear that from a humanitarian perspective, that's where growth is needed. Growth is needed, income growth is needed, real access to better conditions of life is needed in those poorest countries for basically humanitarian reasons. When you look at those statistics, it's just very stark that if you want a fairer world, if you want a world in which a tenth of children don't die before their fifth birthday, then that's where you put the effort. That's where you put the effort to grow the economy, to improve conditions of life, to increase people's incomes, to give them decent health and decent education systems. And while we are in any sense under a kind of scarcity of global resources, and while we're under in any sense a scarcity of ecological limits, it's blindingly obvious that we shouldn't be making, you know, fast cars and big yachts for the richest people in the world. We should just be providing basic access to education and health for the poorest in the world. And if you're talking about, you know, the goods that growth can do, that's where it can do it.
Does technology provide an escape from the biophysical limits to growth?
Technology is important. I mean, it's vital, really. None of the transformation of a world of 9-10 billion people by the middle of this century is going to be possible without technology. But it isn't on its own a solution. It's not something that we can expect to solve all of our problems without thinking about the system that's created those problems. It is an essential part of that solution, but we shouldn't think of it, I think, as a kind of a sort of panacea, something that we can just call on miraculously to solve all those problems. And in particular, we need to figure out how we have a financial system that invests in the right kind of technology, the technology that can actually make things better. And that's a deeper question. It's not just, you know, can we have a few clever people inventing a few clever devices that will make energy without calling on fossil fuels at all? That is a deeper question about the structure of the economic system, and those are the questions that we need to be asking.
Last two questions, an actual and very British question.
Yeah.
Is the Brexit a real possibility?
It's a possibility.
What would be the consequences economically?
I don't know. It is a possibility. Sadly, it is a possibility. I mean, the UK has always been a little bit ambivalent about its role in Europe. Certainly, kind of slightly suspicious of over top-heavy regulation and governance, and also with a sort of sense of independence that comes probably from having a small, narrow passage of water between the mainland and the island. And those are conditions that are, you know, partly cultural, partly geographical, partly economic, that have haunted the relationship between the UK and Europe. My own feeling is that it would be a deep error. It would be a mistake for the UK to leave the European Union, and I really hope that it doesn't happen. The economic consequences would be probably not particularly healthy either for the EU or for the UK. And I think in some ways worse than that is that the cultural consequences, the social consequences would be like turning back history. It would be like turning back a world in which actually Europe achieved a level of coherence and commonality and sociality, and saying we're going back to the individual warring of nation states against each other. And I think that's a backward step. I very much hope that people will vote to stay in June.
Thank you for the interview.